Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Before we say hello to the new year, let us say goodbye to 2014. That includes saying goodbye to some people we lost. We saw them in movies, read their books, sang their songs, and even wore their clothing. Marcia James tells about 9 people who made a difference.
Many people were shocked when they learned that American actor Robin Williams committed suicide. The comedian was known for inventing funny dialogue and scenes, but he had a long battle with depression. Some of his most famous movies were Good Morning Vietnam, Dead Poets Society, and Mrs. Doubtfire. Sir Richard Attenborough was a respected English actor, director, producer, and entrepreneur. He spent 20 years trying to make a movie about the life of Mahatma Gandhi. He finally succeeded. The film Gandhi won 8 Academy Awards, including a Best Director Oscar for Mr. Attenborough. Over 360 films credit the work of Run Run Shaw. He was one of the pioneers of the 20th century Chinese film industry. His movie, Five Fingers of Death, is considered a kung fu classic. Later, Run Run Shaw became a major philanthropist. He donated billions of dollars to schools, charities, and hospitals in China. Legendary singer Pete Seeger helped create the modern folk music movement. Artists around the world have recorded his songs, including If I Had a Hammer and Turn, Turn, Turn. His best-known work is probably the church song We Shall Overcome. Mr. Seeger did not write the song, but he helped link it to the American Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. In 1969, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou made literary history. It was the first nonfiction bestseller by an African-American woman. Miss Angelou rose from poverty, segregation, and violence to become a powerful public and creative figure. Americans who did not already know her work heard it at Bill Clinton's inauguration in 1993. There, Miss Angelou read her poem, On the Pulse of the Morning. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos described Gabriel Garcia Marquez as the greatest Colombian who ever lived. Many consider him one of the most important authors of the 20th century. His works include 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Time of Cholera. Mr. Gabriel Marquez was affectionately known as Gabo throughout Latin America. He wrote in the style of magic realism. In other words, he combined the real with the impossible. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was a political leader and military general. He served as the 11th Prime Minister of Israel. Ariel Sharon helped define events in the Middle East for decades. One of his most important decisions was to turn over Gaza and parts of the West Bank to Palestinian control. He died 8 years after suffering a severe stroke. Oscar de la Renta was not a politician. He was a fashion designer who was born in the Dominican Republic and trained by top Spanish designers. But one of his most famous clients was American First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy. Mr. De Laurentiis also made dresses for movie stars, and he eventually became a star himself. Indian guru B.K.S. Iyengar suffered from tuberculosis, typhoid, and malaria as a child. He said doing yoga saved his life. Mr. Iyengar became one of the most important and powerful teachers of yoga around the world. His kind of yoga, called Iyengar Yoga, requires people to stay in a yoga position for a long time. It demands strength, desire, and discipline. I'm Marcia James.
New Year's is a holiday for memories and hopes for the future. The past and the future come together at midnight. Not surprisingly, emotions are as much a part of New Year's celebrations as noisemakers and fireworks. After all, a traditional way to welcome the new year is to kiss somebody you love. Shirley Griffith tells us about a New Year's song that honors old, dear friends.
That is a song millions of Americans will hear this New Year's Eve. It is called Auld Lang Syne. It is the traditional music played during the New Year's celebration. Auld Lang Syne is an old Scottish poem. It tells about the need to remember old friends. The words Auld Lang Syne mean old, long since. No one knows who wrote the poem first. However, a version by Scottish poet Robert Burns was published in 1796. The words and music we know today first appeared in a songbook 3 years later. The song is sung in the United States mainly on New Year's Eve. Here is Lou Rawls singing his version of it.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and days of old lang syne? For auld lang syne, my dear, for auld lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for auld lang syne. For auld lang syne, my dear, for auld lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for auld lang syne.
This is Shirley Griffith.
And I'm Jerry Watson. Today, I am saying goodbye, too. This is my final program with VOA Learning English. Thank you for being part of my 25 years here. I wish you all the best in your efforts to learn English. Happy New Year!
Thank you.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Award-winning Ugandan education activist Beatrice Ayuru says thousands of girls have reached her dream of a good education for Ugandan children. But she said the struggle to guarantee schooling for all is far from over. Ms. Ayuru spoke to VOA before appearing at a TEDx event in Geneva, Switzerland. TED is a nonprofit group that works to share information and ideas by organizing short public speeches. For her TED talk, Ms. Ayuru discussed her long and successful struggle to establish a school in a rural area of northern Uganda. In 2000, she opened Lira Integrated School in a poor area of the city of Lira. At the time, the Rebel Lords Resistance Army was terrorizing the area's population with murder, torture, and child kidnappings. The story of Ms. Ayuru's activism begins in her own childhood. She was one of 16 children in a polygamous family. Her father valued education and supported her desire for it. But she said the poverty and cultural barriers affecting women in her society worked against her.
I would say the environment shaped me a lot. Even while I felt I was going through hard moments, but other girls were worse than me. They were forced into early marriages. They were not given opportunity to be in school. It was a very painful life.
She graduated from high school to become the first student from her school to gain admission to a national university. After completing a degree from Makerere University, she began teaching. At age 19, Ms. Ayuru had just become the mother of the second of her six children. She had no money, but her father gave her land. She says it was the need to support her children that made her work hard.
When I realized what I have was land, I'm already teaching but not earning salary, so I started with planting cassava. That was all I could afford, using my energy because I could not employ people to do anything.
Later, she opened some small businesses. Money from those and the cassava crop helped her build the school in 2000. But continuing attacks from the Lord's Resistance Army threatened the school.
During the war, we would always run with the children from school to the town to hide them. Then during the day, we collect them from town, again come and have lessons.
In 2007, the LRA lost its fight for control of northern Uganda and fled the area. Beatrice Ayuru's school has been doing well ever since. It teaches 1,500 students from nursery through high school. The cost to attend is about $90 a year. Many parents cannot pay. So the school gives financial help to 100 children who lack money but show promise. Lira Integrated School accepts both girls and boys. Ms. Ayuru says having both sexes study together is important because it helps boys to respect girls. In 2009, the school founder took steps toward building a university. Beatrice Ayuru says she is getting closer to reaching her dream. I'm Jerry Watson. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1863, Union forces defeated Confederate forces in the bloodiest battle of the American Civil War, the Battle of Gettysburg. Soon after that, the Union won another important victory, seizing Vicksburg, Mississippi. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue our story of the Civil War with the Battle of Vicksburg.
In November 1863, President Lincoln traveled to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He spoke at the opening of a military cemetery. He felt very tired by the time he got back to Washington. Doctors thought he had a cold. Later, they said he had a weak form of smallpox. The president remained in bed. Few visitors could see him. There was a danger the smallpox could spread. Lincoln got better after a few weeks. He began working on his yearly message to Congress. After 2.5 years of war, he had good news to report. Union armies had gained 2 important victories at about the same time.
One was the Battle of Gettysburg. Union forces, led by General George Meade, had defeated Confederate forces, led by General Robert E. Lee. They pushed Lee back into Virginia. It was the last Confederate invasion of the North. The day after the Battle of Gettysburg, Union forces defeated Confederate forces at Vicksburg, Mississippi. This victory gave them control of the Mississippi River, and it split the states of the Confederacy.
Union General Ulysses Grant had been trying to seize Vicksburg for several months. It was not easy. Vicksburg lay on the east side of the Mississippi River. It was built high above the water on a rocky cliff. As the river flowed past Vicksburg, it turned in sharply at the base of the cliff and then continued on to the Gulf of Mexico. The Confederates had placed cannon all along the sharp turn in the river. Enemy boats sailing past made easy targets.
General Grant began the campaign for Vicksburg in late 1862. His army was west of the Mississippi River. He needed to get to the other side to attack the city. First, Grant planned to cross the river into northern Mississippi State. Then he would march south to Vicksburg. He crossed the river, but Confederate forces destroyed his transportation and supply lines. He withdrew. Early in 1863, he tried again.
This time, he planned to sail his men past Vicksburg. They would cross the river a little downstream, turn, and attack. Grant moved 40,000 men to a point 10 kilometers from Vicksburg. He told the men to put down their guns and take up digging tools. They would build a canal to carry them past the turn in the river, past the Confederate cannon.
For weeks, the Union soldiers worked on the canal. They dug through mud and wet clay. Many died of disease. After more than a month of digging, engineers decided that the canal would not work. Grant ordered the men to build another canal, then another. They did not work either. By this time, the Union soldiers had become experts at digging canals. One of them said, "As soon as the canals at Vicksburg are finished, we are going to cut a canal across the upper part of Florida. We will cut that state off from the Confederacy and give it to the alligators."
Finally, in April 1863, Grant gave up all ideas of getting past Vicksburg without a fight. He decided to march most of his men down the west side of the river to a steamboat landing 30 kilometers below Vicksburg. He would send his Navy boats past the city at night and hope for the best. It took 3 weeks for Grant's men to reach the steamboat landing. The roads were very rough. In many places, they were covered with water. Engineers had to cut trees and cover the muddy roads with logs so wagons would not sink. They had to build bridges over the many streams.
On the night of April 16th, the Union Navy made its run past Vicksburg. 8 gunboats and 3 empty troop boats floated down the dark river. Their engines were silent. The Confederates, however, had built fires along the river. They saw the Union boats and began to shoot. They hit most of the boats, but destroyed only one. The damaged boats reached safety below the city. On the last day of April, the Union troop boats began carrying soldiers to the east side of the river. About 23,000 men crossed. Right away, they faced a force of 8,000 Confederate soldiers. They drove the Confederates back.
Grant then ordered the rest of his army to cross to the east side of the river. Some of his officers protested. They said it would be impossible to get supplies to a large army east of the river. Grant was not worried about supplies. He said the men should bring only coffee, hard bread, and salt. Anything else could be taken from the farmers of Mississippi. Their homes, he said, were full of food.
Grant decided not to throw his men against the strong defenses around Vicksburg immediately. Instead, he marched them east toward Jackson, the state capital. Jackson was the supply base for the Confederate Army defending Vicksburg. Grant wanted to cut the supply lines between the two cities. He also wanted to prevent the soldiers in Jackson from joining the soldiers in Vicksburg. Grant captured Jackson easily. He left some troops to destroy enemy supplies. He took the remaining troops and turned back toward Vicksburg.
Grant attacked Vicksburg several times. Each time, his troops were thrown back. The city's defenses were too strong. Grant then decided to surround the city and wait until its food was gone. That, he thought, would make the Confederates surrender. Grant closed in with men and artillery. As one soldier wrote, "The circle of Union forces around the city was so tight that a cat could not have crept out without being discovered. Nothing could get out, nothing could get in." Weeks passed. The Union army shelled the city. The Confederate army answered from time to time. Food supplies dropped. There was little to eat except cornbread and the meat of mules. Some people caught rats and ate them.
Finally, the Confederate commander, General John Pemberton, decided the situation was hopeless. He sent word to Grant that he was ready to discuss surrender. The two commanders met under a white flag of truce. Grant demanded unconditional surrender. Pemberton rejected the demand. Pemberton's men were to be prisoners. That was a fact. But Pemberton wanted them released immediately on parole. He told Grant that his men would promise to stay out of the war if permitted to return to their homes. If not, he said, they would continue to fight.
Grant agreed to let the Confederate soldiers go home. He and Pemberton signed the surrender agreement on July 4th. The siege of Vicksburg had lasted 47 days. Never had a Union army won such a victory. Grant had taken 30,000 Confederate soldiers out of the war. He had captured 60,000 guns and 170 cannon. These were serious losses for the Confederacy. It already was low on manpower and weapons, but an even greater loss was the control of the Mississippi River. With Vicksburg in Union hands, the North could control the whole length of the river, and the Confederacy was split badly.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. You can find transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.